Hello, everyone. I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to another edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. We're going to begin today talking about an organization that some of you may or may not have heard of. They're called the ITU, which stands for International Telecommunications Union. They're based in Switzerland, and they're part of the United Nations. Now, what is their job exactly? Well, their job actually is to standardize globally all communications. To talk a little bit more about exactly what they do, we're now joined by Bob Zanotti.
I personally have been down at the ITU many, many times when I was working at Swiss Radio International. I used to report on telecommunication issues and so on. And a thumbnail history. The ITU, like a few of the other UN specialized agencies, as they're officially called, were created for a very, very good reason. They're very pragmatic. They're not political organizations, they're technical organizations. The International Telecommunication Union used to be called and was founded, I believe, in 1884 as the International Telegraph Union. And of course, for those who don't know, and maybe some people don't, in those days, there was only one means of international communication, and that was the telegraph. International telephone service was not even thought of at the time. And so the need was there to coordinate the efforts and the technical standards of telegraph service all over the world. And then later on in the 20th century, this evolved as technology evolved. Things got sophisticated. We had radio, we had telephone, we had television, and that called for a more sophisticated organization. And it was renamed and reorganized and called the ITU, International Telecommunication Union. Or you're from Montreal, if you like, UIT, Union Internationale de Télécommunications en français.
So, in effect, the ITU looks over almost everything that we use, from just, you know, like you mentioned, telegrams to modern internet communications to telephone calls to satellite. They really oversee the whole gamut of telecommunications.
Well, let me put it to you this way, Keith. I'm a critical, in the best sense of the word, I'm a critical journalist. And I can tell you in all truth and honesty, the ITU is one of the best functioning and most important organizations within the family of United Nations specialized agencies. It's up there, for example, with the UPU, the Universal Postal Union, which was founded in Bern around the same time as the Telegraph Union. Without these organizations, the world's communications, the data transfer would not function. You and I, and this is not a dramatization or over-dramatization or melodrama, you and I literally could not talk right now over Skype without the ITU. I'll tell you why. It's simply because in the evolution of international communication, electronic communication, every nation developed its own standards. And they had to be coordinated. For example, it seems very simple to pick up a telephone today, and we can talk all over the world. Nobody thinks about it. There are international access codes. But behind that are international agreements among all the members of the ITU that coordinate and permit the access of this international telephony, interfacing from one system to the other. Not all telephone standards are the same. We have the same thing in radio, television. For example, let's take our favorite subject, shortwave broadcasting, even medium wave, FM broadcasting. All the world has to agree on what frequencies are allocated for these services. How big is the audio bandwidth going to be? And then we have the issue of coordinating all of these frequencies internationally so that everybody doesn't wind up on the same frequency. This is the daily job of the ITU.
Now, Bob, let's get on to another subject. Quite recently, I was speaking to somebody in the frequency department of a well-known U.S. international broadcaster. I think you know who it is. The Voice of America.
I've heard of them, yes.
Yes. And he told me that the VOA doesn't put much confidence in the ITU because they said they have many times submitted letters to the ITU about jamming or, as the ITU calls it, interference issues. And he says they keep sending these letters once a month, and nothing ever gets done. Is that because this is out of the ITU's jurisdiction?
No, it's within their jurisdiction, but let's define their jurisdiction. Their jurisdiction is defined by governments. In international diplomacy, the ITU is known as an intergovernmental organization within the UN system. So is the UN itself. The UN, despite what Alex Jones might say, or some other people who are afraid of a world government, the United Nations is not a world government, nor are its specialized agencies. They are slaves to the will of its membership, and its membership, in this case, is all of the world governments that are members of the ITU. So, as far as the VOA complaining is concerned, I don't quite see that, because they should well know that the ITU is not empowered to intervene in questions of what they technically and officially call harmful interference. The word jamming does not appear in any United Nations documents, any official ones anyway. One delegate from one country or the other might use the word, but it's not recognized as a technical term. They refer only to harmful interference. But the ITU is not a world policeman. They have no power and authority. They only can do what the membership, in other words, the member governments and administrations, which in this case would be in the U.S., the Federal Communications Commission, has empowered them to do. So I think it's a bit unfair to complain that they don't do anything about jamming. It's not their job. They're not empowered to do anything about jamming. All they can do, and this is their job, is to call to the attention of the membership, in other words, the national administrations, the government agencies of the respective countries responsible for telecommunications, of potential or conflicts, as they call them. Here we get into frequency planning. This is part of the ITU's job. And beyond that, there's really not much they can do. It's not their fault.
Now, you just said a moment ago that the ITU is not a policing agency. So ITU members, are they required to follow ITU rules, or can they, within their own borders, say, you know what, we're going to do what we want?
Yes and no. Again, we get back to the subject that the ITU is a slave to the membership. And they can't enforce anything. And when the international rules and regulations or protocols, as they're called, officially in diplomacy, are agreed, many countries make sure that they write in what are called footnotes. We will abide by the general consensus, except, however, one of the famous cases. I think I'm correct about the frequency. One of the legendary exceptions was the BBC World Service on the frequency of 9410 years ago, way outside of the broadcast band. In other words, so-called out-of-band operation. There is a paragraph or a footnote, as it's technically called, in the frequency allocations that were written in or was written in by governments like the UK or the United States and others, basically saying, we will abide basically by the rules and regulations, except we reserve the right to derogations. That's another ITU diplomatic expression, as we see fit. Now, the clause that covers this, and I can't remember the paragraph, I think it's 32 of something, I don't remember. Basically, what it says is, you have to keep within the allocated, officially recognized frequency bands. However, if you wander outside or choose a frequency outside of those bands, and if no complaint is received, I think it's within 30 days of establishing yourself on that frequency, no matter what it is, then you're entitled to use it, sort of squatter's rights. And the BBC was doing that on 9410 for many, many years. The Vatican, for example, does the same thing on 4005. They're running, interestingly enough, I'm not quite sure who they're directing it to. It's technically utility band, but they're broadcasting Vatican radio in reduced carrier single sideband minus 6 dB. They get away with it because nobody's complained. So, you know, it's like everything else in politics. It's all yes and no, but maybe, on the other hand, we can't be sure. Every government that signs any kind of a document always wants to make sure that there's an escape clause in it. And again, I have to repeat, this is not the fault of the ITU. They have no authority over its membership. They are the slaves and servants of the membership, and the membership is a bunch of governments who decide how it works and what it does. I would like to mention one thing. I think it was a major development in the ITU streamlining in terms of frequency allocation. We're talking of what's technically called HF broadcasting. In other words, shortwave broadcasting. It's known as high-frequency broadcasting. Many, many years ago, the ITU had a meeting every year in Geneva where all the delegations from all over the world came together and tried to agree on frequency allocation. It didn't work so well. It worked fairly well, but it didn't work as well as it could have done. So this was the genesis of the HFCC, the High Frequency Coordinating Committee. You've reported on this on PCJ. I've reported on it with Jeff White on Switzerland in Sound. And it's quite a good thing. It's a very pragmatic attempt to get all of the players in international broadcasting, shortwave broadcasting, HF broadcasting together. And they sit down and they get into a room, basically, literally, and they hammer out arrangements and they work it all out. But here again, technically, the HFCC is a private ad hoc organization. They have no authority, no real legal clout with the ITU. According to the regulations, all of the respective delegates go back to their administrations and go back to their governments and say, this is what we've worked out at the HFCC. But legally, it can only be the administrations of the telecom administrations of the respective governments. They have to hand it in to the ITU, and then it becomes legal, so to speak.
And I was speaking there with Bob Zanotti about the inner workings of the ITU. That's the International Telecommunications Union. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Corey 105, it is Peter Toto Journal.
Space 220, Corey 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Well, we're now turning our attention to a private international broadcaster. In the U.S., of course, there are a number of them. For example, stations like WBCQ in Maine and WRMI in Miami. One of the other stations, of course, that listeners are very familiar with around the world is KNLS. Paul Ladd has been with the station for a number of years.
Thank you. This is Alaska calling. Thanks for making your new life station a part of your Monday. Broadcasting from the top of the world, this is KNLS, Anchor Point, Alaska, USA. I'm Lucy Grant, your host for this.
Well, KNLS is an international shortwave station. We do an hour programming. We do a one-hour program each day in English, another one in Chinese, Mandarin Chinese, and Russian. We do magazine format, and we broadcast the good news, Christian message to the world.
Now, a moment ago, you were saying to me it's quite different from the other Christian broadcasters out there.
It is, and they have what works for them. We have what works for us, and, you know, doesn't mean anybody's better or worse. It just means we're different. And what we do is our programming is 1 hour, and about a third of it is devotional teaching-type segments. These are religious in nature, of course. You're not going to hear any denominational or sectarian agenda. Then we have about a third pop music, because we have found that people in other countries like American pop music. Now, obviously, some songs you're not going to hear on our station because they're talking about things that are, shall we say, naughty or have some naughty words in them. Of course, we're not going to air that. The other third of our programming is feature-type segments, similar to National Public Radio for listeners in America.
But that would be focusing on Christian topics, correct?
Yes and no. We do sometimes. For instance, we've had interviews with Dr. Gary Chapman, who's a family counselor and author. We've had him on. We've also had Senator Joseph Lieberman on, talking about his book, The Gift of Rest. It's about the Sabbath, so I guess that is a faith-based segment. But we've interviewed a lot of interesting authors. We've talked about body language. We've talked about why people are fascinated with celebrities. We've done movie segments, interviewed musical artists. The last third of our programming is what we would call news feature type segments, similar to what you'd hear on National Public Radio if you were listening in the United States. We will have authors on. We'll have artists. We do stories about culture, you know, visual art, musical artists, anybody we can get to sit down with us. And when I am putting together a segment, the first thing I think about, Keith, is would I want to listen to this stuff? And if I don't want to listen to it, I figure other people are going to find it more. I try to make it interesting. You know, I do my part. I just hope the audience likes it.
Now, you said you broadcast over shortwave. I mean, we've seen so many cuts happen in shortwave. The BBC, Radio Netherlands, the VOA cut back on frequencies dramatically, some of them even going off air, like Radio Sweden, recently Radio Bulgaria. Why is this station still focused on shortwave so much?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because a lot of the people we're trying to reach are people who live in remote areas. The stations, their local media is controlled by the government, so they're not even allowed to hear some of the stuff that we would be doing. But if they've got a shortwave radio, they can pick us up. Shortwave radio can cross geographical boundaries that a lot of other stations simply cannot. And we're committed to it because we want to reach people. We have a good message, we have good news, and we want to get it to good people. And that is the way we figure to do it. We are very committed. Our president, Charles Caudle, recently spoke to the HFCC, and he pointed out that we're not interested in, you know, promoting a government point of view. We're interested in reaching people with this message, and we still think this is the best way to do it.
And I think one of the advantages, and I heard somebody say this, they said, well, if you're going to be leaving shortwave, that's better for us. Less interference for us. Thank you, guys.
That was a quote from Charles in his article. I believe it was published in Radio World later.
Hello, 您好，欢迎您收听生命之光广播电台。 生命之光是世界各地的一群基督徒组成的。电台在美国阿拉斯加州的安克角，电台的总部和录音室在美国田纳西州的法兰克林市。我们很高兴天天为您制作节目，也希望您在听完节目之后来信告诉我们您的感想。现在就请您欣赏这个小时的华语节目。
How many hours a week do you produce? Because you said you produce 1 hour in English. What about the other languages?
Each of our three existing services, which are English, Mandarin Chinese, and Russian, do a 1 hour show each day. And they're recorded in advance, so it's not live. And we do the 1 hour each day, so we do 7 hours a week, but it's broadcast several times on different frequencies in order to reach different people. We have broadcast, the English hour I know is broadcast 4 times daily, the Russian hour 6 times daily, and the Chinese hour 10 times daily on different frequencies from our 2 transmitters in Anchor Point, Alaska. We will be adding, once the Madagascar World Voice station is on the air, we'll be adding Arabic programming, and we'll be adding some African English, because most of the countries in Africa, English is their common second language. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of languages in Africa. It would be impossible to broadcast in all of them. We will also be doing some Spanish and Portuguese programming. We have a Spanish program now that airs out of Miami on WRMI. It's once a week. And Rex Morgan, who's our senior producer for Spanish, is the host of that program. And we'll be doing an hour a day once Madagascar World Voice is on the air.
What kind of power do you have at the relay in Alaska?
Very high. I believe they said it's 1,000,000 watts. I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm. So 100 kilowatt
yes.
transmitters.
That sounds right, yes. I'm not the technical guy, but we get listeners from all over. We've had mail from more than 200 countries and every state in the union. And we never know, because of the way shortwave frequencies skip and all that sort of thing, we never know where we're going to get listeners from. Now, granted, we always know we'll be hearing a lot from Japan and Australia and the Far East, but we get some from Europe, the States. We have a lot of listeners in India, Canada. So we hear from all of them.
When your programming goes out in these different languages, is it all produced here in the United States, or do you also have, let's say, studios overseas where that will contribute to those programs?
In Madagascar, there will be some local programming. Most of the programming will still be produced at our production center in the United States. Almost all of our programming is in-house. There is a movie segment and a science segment that are produced by another company or another entity. But our feature segments, musical segments, all that sort of thing, we do it all in-house.
The plans for the future, you said you have a number of languages right now. Do you see the stations, let's say, because you'll have the Madagascar relay, you said you're going to, of course, add more hours in English. Do you think the possibility is there to even maybe add, let's say, French for Africa, which is also widely spoken? And let's say Portuguese?
Those are being discussed. Portuguese, definitely, and French is also a possibility. We want to reach as many people as we can. Obviously, it's impossible for our organization, or any group for that matter, to broadcast in every language there is on the earth, because there are hundreds. But we want to reach as many people as we can, and French is under consideration also. And we're also hoping at some point to reach people in the States, because there are a lot of ethnic communities from different countries that come to America, and their native tongue is still their primary tongue. We want to be able to reach them as well.
I remember when I was a lad, times were hard and things were bad.
there's a silver lining. That was Paul Ladd from radio station KNLS in the United States. Let's now turn our attention to propagation. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through June 11th. Normal at all latitudes, except normal to fair at high latitudes on June 11th. From Space Weather South Africa through June 11th, magnetic conditions quiet to unsettled, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through June 12th, solar activity expected to remain at very low levels. Geomagnetic activity expecting an enhancement in the solar wind from a high-speed stream on the 11th and 12th, bringing some active spells and just a slight chance of minor storm intervals. From Space Weather Canada, a peak of magnetic activity in polar, auroral, and subauroral zones is foreseen for June 18th. From FK Yanda of the Czech Propagation Interest Group, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to unsettled on June 10th, 13th, 14th, and 28th. Quiet to active June 11th, 12th, 19th, and 24th to 27th. Mostly quiet June 15th to 17th, 21st, 23rd, and 29th. Active to disturbed on June 18th. Quiet on June 20th and 22nd. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field unsettled to active levels expected on June 12th to 15th, 17th, 18th, 23rd, 24th, and 26th to 27th, with ANKNC's peaking at 15 and 5 on June 17th, 12 and 4 on June 12th, 13th, and 24th. G1 minor storm levels likely on July 2nd, with A's and K's of 25 and 5. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 on June 10th, 11th, 16th, 19th to 22nd, and 28th to July 1st. Solar flux rising slightly from 82 on June 10th to a peak of only 90 on June 15th to 20th, and down to 78 by June 29th. William Hepburn's VHF UHF DX maps call for extreme tropospheric ducting between Peru and Chile, June 11th to 13th. Off the coast of West Africa around Cape Verde until June 12th, off the southwest coast of Mexico, and the central to eastern Mediterranean starting June 12th. All week along the coast of Angola, and extremely extreme all week on all sides of the Arabian Peninsula as far as India. RSGB says, if you do one thing, check the VHF bands for sporadic E around tea time before eating, and you'll catch most of what develops.
And with that, we end this edition of Media Network Plus. If you wish to contact us, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. Of course, you can listen to this program again, as well as all past editions, by visiting our website at any time, pcjmedia.com, and click on the link for Media Network Plus. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying goodbye, so long, farewell, 73, and of course, 88, to the ladies.